bag of tricks to help me do the talk, possibly over £1,000 worth of things in here, which we'll get onto later, but that should make it awesome. I'm not sure about the talk. I do some talking at work. I'm an accountant, for those of you who don't know, and that does make doing talks and presentations difficult. You go to kind of classes on how to do presentations well, and one of the things you get told is you need a catchy title. Now, if you're an accountant, that can be hard. You have to come up with things like, well, the credit crunch, or creative accounting. But it's difficult. So I thought, well, here I am talking to the church. There's a lot more to talk about. It must be much easier to come up with a really catchy title. We've seen lots of the young people today. I thought, well, we need something that the young people can kind of think of as interesting. One of my daughter's friends has recently been up to Stratford to see a production of Hamlet starring David Tennant. And I thought, well, that's kind of time travel. I could entitle my talk Time Travel, and that would really make people think, what's this going to be about? And then I thought, well, you have to remember that although a lot of people stood up this morning, there are some older people in the audience, and they might think, well, if we wanted to hear about time travel, we'd sit at home and watch Doctor Who. And I thought, you could do a talk entitled Common Sense. And the older people would think, well, that's exactly what we need. If you're like me and you travel on the tube and the underground and the train, you'd think, young people need common sense. They need not to play their iPods so loud that everybody else in the carriage can hear. Common sense is what's wrong with the world. People are losing common sense. They're not being polite. They're not working properly. But then I thought, well, the younger people will just put their earphones in and switch off, and it's not nearly as easy as it looks. So I've entitled my talk Time Travel and Common Sense, which I thought was a good compromise. Now, it may surprise you to learn that I actually am a time traveller. Some silence there. I have spoken to the BBC about this fact. I thought, I'm an accountant. It would be more interesting perhaps working as a special advisor on the Doctor Who programme. And I started having an interesting conversation. They kind of said, well, yes, it sounds interesting that you're a time traveller. Can you tell us a bit more about it? How do you travel through time? And I explained that I travel through time. Being a Christian, I'm a bit traditionalist. I travel through time kind of 60 seconds a minute, 60 minutes an hour, 24 hours in a day. And at this point, they got a bit bored. And that's one of the troubles if you're a time traveller. People don't take you particularly seriously. So hopefully this morning, I'm going to make you look at time travellers in a slightly different light. Now, if you're a time traveller, as if you're any kind of specialist, you have to try and make it sound interesting and use some specialist terms. So if you're a time traveller, you don't say, I've been travelling through time for 40-odd years. I'm careful not to be too specific there. You would say, well, actually, I've been travelling through time today for 16,085 days. And you talk about travelling in days if you're a time traveller, because that sounds good. That sounds better. And unless you've got some very good mathematicians, which generally you don't have in these days with the Poppet calculator, no one will be able to work out from that exactly how old I am. Now, when did I get interested in time travel? Probably. Actually, before I go on to time travel, I'm going to just talk very briefly about common sense, because that was the other bit. Now, if I was very switched on, I could probably give you a definition of common sense if I was a kind of Simon Jeffries or a Craig from pressing a few buttons even in here and bringing something up on the internet. But I'm going to give you a slightly more traditional definition of common sense, because that's the other thing the talk is about. And common sense isn't too difficult. Common sense is just the way we act with the world. It's the obviousness about the life around us. It's you get up in the morning and you switch a switch and a light comes on. That's common sense. Common sense is when you walk down the road, you don't suddenly step off the curb without looking. You might get run over. There's some bigger things with common sense that probably most of us agree, and most of us in this country would agree it's common sense that people pay taxes and we have a health service so that people who are kind of more challenged or people who are older or people who are ill can be looked after. So there's all sorts of things that are kind of common sense in the lives around us. Now, the dictionary, being a dictionary, has a slightly more interesting definition of common sense. It says, that school of philosophy which takes the universally admitted impressions of mankind as corresponding to the facts of things without further scrutiny. So that's basically saying that common sense is just the way the world seems around us, and we need common sense. Without common sense, we'd kind of go go balmy. It's important. But we'll come on to common sense again in a minute. Back to time travel. Now, I wonder sometimes if I got interested in time travel when we used to go and stay with my grandfather, who lived in the wilds of Lincolnshire, and we used to go and visit him every holiday. So actually, I probably spent about a month a year down there. And the house was on the Lincolnshire Fen, which is completely flat. And you would lie in bed at night, and you would listen to the wind whistling through the telegraph wires. And what you would also hear was his clock. He had this beautiful kind of, like, I think they call them Napoleon hat clocks now, which sat on the sideboard. And I'm not very musical, so I can't do it very well, but it would do the Westminster chime. So that's the chime that goes ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. It's probably a slightly flat version of it, but. And that kind of has haunted me down the years, actually, a longing for a kind of a clock that does that. And for my 40th birthday, my friends and my family kind of clubbed together, and actually they bought me a clock which does that. Now, obviously, if you're a time traveller, clocks, or as we call them, kind of chronological measurement devices, are very, very important because they're how you know where you've got to in time. And, well, if I describe my clock, it's very obvious. It's a clock. It's common sense. You look at a clock and it's pretty obvious what it is. So I was somewhat astounded. And when you're a time traveller, you notice, I mean, David Tennant has this problem, you notice these kind of things happen. Suddenly you get a fraction or a shiver in time and something isn't quite right. So my clock was on the wall. It's a beautiful clock. It chimes beautifully. But my little boy, he had a problem with it. He kind of looked at it and said, well, it looks like a clock. It has a face, it has hands, but it's not a clock, or not a proper clock, which was somewhat of a surprise to me, because I thought it was a very proper clock. And the source of his problem was this. This is a key, and as far as he was concerned, keys are things you use to open doors with. If you're in our house, keys are things you often also search for. But he was very surprised that my clock and this key kind of had any connection with each other. And you suddenly step back from the clock and common sense, and I can actually suddenly see what he's saying, because at some point in the 1970s, clocks stopped having kind of keys, or lots of clocks did, and they started having batteries, and they started having quartz crystals inside. And although I think, and it seems incredibly obvious to me, being my age, that a clock has a key in it and you wind it up, to him it was actually perfectly logical that clocks aren't like that. Clocks are more like that thing up there. Or clocks, even in John Lewis now, you can buy clocks which have quartz crystals inside and pendulums that appear to swing. And I had to kind of hold him up, and fortunately the clock had a glass side, and he could peer inside it, and he was utterly astounded that inside it there were springs, there were cogs, and it was whirring away like some kind of magical device, although to me it just seemed a clock. But you get something interesting there about common sense, because he and I are looking at the same object in time, and we're actually seeing something different. I am seeing something that's obviously, logically, a clock. And he's seeing something which isn't quite a proper clock. There's something happened there, although we're both looking at the same thing. Now, being a time traveller, we do have other kind of interesting artefacts in our house, some of which get forgotten. I have another one up here to talk about and demonstrate the principle. Now, this was discovered in our house this week by actually my young son again, who's possibly going to be a time traveller, I don't know. We'd been doing some clearing out, and he found a book, and he said, well, what's this book? And it was a book I'd kind of almost forgotten I'd got. And I opened it up, and it was given to me by my grandfather, probably about 20 or 30 years ago, but has sat in my parents' loft for a long time. And they've just given it to me because they cleared out the loft. And it's a Bible. It's was my grandfather's Bible. And Zachary said, which was kind of quite interesting, well, how old is it? And that caused a bit of a problem. It's got some writing in the back. Charlotte Clement wrote in it at Fosdyke, which is in Lincolnshire, on Sunday, December the 24th. That was Christmas Eve, when she was age 17. And the date there is 1848, so it's quite old. It's an old Bible, and being a Bible, it's good. We then did some more investigation, because it's also a Bible kind of not in brilliant condition. And we discovered one of the other problems you get when you're a time traveller, because it does have on it, in Roman numerals, a date. And I discovered that as you're a time traveller, you move further away every day at the rate of 60 seconds a minute from your education, and you do tend to forget things. So on one of the inside papers, it says MDCXXX. And I could remember that M stood for 1,000, but we had to scrabble about and get the dictionary and look for a very long time before we got to the bit where it told you what MDCXXX meant. And MDC is M is 1,000, D is 500, C is 100, and XXX are each tens. And that gets you to 1630. And we thought, well, it's a King James Bible. That's kind of when King James was alive. So is this the date that the King James Bible comes from, and how old actually is this Bible? We investigated on the internet, and that's where it almost makes the hairs on the back of my head stand on end, because it also says it was published by a certain Robert Barker in London, Robert Barker. And we did some double-clicking, and suddenly, mysteriously, magically, I can't quite get the page, one of the pages of the Bible appeared on the internet, staring out at us. And Robert Barker was actually a printer in London about 1630, and we suddenly realised that this Bible actually dates from 1630. And just to put that into perspective, Queen Elizabeth I died in 1603. The Fire of London didn't happen until 1666. The Great Plague happened in 1665. The actual King James Bible itself, King James commanded the translation to begin in 1604, and the very first Bible wasn't published till 1611. And when this Bible was printed in 1630, printing itself was only about 100 years old. So it's actually, as a time traveller, an incredibly interesting artefact, and probably one of the oldest Bibles you will see. I thought, I can't really bring it here without reading from it, so I'm going to try and do two things, make two points at the same time, which being a bloke is going to be a bit difficult, but I'm sure the female members of the audience will cope with very well. So you've got to remember what I'm actually reading for slightly later in the talk, but this is from Matthew 13, and you're actually being read to from a Bible that kind of predates the Fire of London, predates the Great Plague, has travelled as a time traveller. You know, actually, if you talk about time travel, this thing has travelled through nearly 400 years to get to us. Shakespeare himself had only been dead 10 or so years when this was actually printed. So here we go, Matthew 4, verse 13. And this is about the wise men calling on Herod just before Jesus was born. And when they departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeareth to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise, and take the young child and his mother, and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I bring thee word. For Herod will take the young child to destroy him. And I'm actually doing quite a lot of translating there, because it's actually quite difficult to read. They hadn't standardised spelling. All the S's look like F's. And they changed the spelling of the word depending on how many words they were trying to fit on a line. So you get another interesting thing about common sense. If you'd shown this to somebody in 1630, I mean, like my clock, it's much more obviously a Bible, of course, stupid. This is what a Bible looks like. If I show it to you, it's slightly worn around the edges. It did also say on the internet that Bible bindings, this is probably calfskin leather, only tend to last 200 or 300 years. The pages, because they're made without acid and they're much thicker than the pages of a modern Bible, are generally good for 1,000 years. So the Bible's not quite halfway through its life. But I've lost my thread now. But yes, the Bible, it's the same Bible, and yet it looks very mysterious and very different. And that's the really interesting thing about common sense and about the way you look at them, and that's what you see as a time traveller, that as you move through time, things change, and you suddenly get a little crack in the way you see something. I mean, this is the same Bible that people used to look at, and it was obviously a Bible. Now it's something very different, very strange, and something that absolutely wouldn't look out of place in a museum. And you get that in common sense with everything. And I've got a few more kind of illustrations of that. There's common sense is the way we think of the world and the world, the way the world seems ordinary. There's a brilliant movie that some of you probably have seen called The Truman Show. And Truman is a chap who has forever lived in a TV soap opera, except he is the only one who doesn't know it. He lives in a huge studio, which appears like the sky, with a sun that goes across it, and it's a real small-town American world he appears to live in. It's surrounded by water. The producers have artfully made him very frightened of water because his father apparently drowned when Truman was a little boy. And Truman never wants to leave this place he lives on because the only way out of it is across a bridge that goes over water. So he never actually wants to explore the outside world. He's just happy to kind of watch it on television. And to him, it's common sense that this is his world. He doesn't realise that everybody else in it is actually actors and actresses, and he's being filmed the whole time on television. Now, one day, a kind of crack suddenly happens in Truman's world. He's tootling off to work in his car, and some static comes on the radio, and what he's actually listening to is the director, because although to Truman, people are walking around the sidewalks, cars are passing in front of him, actually there are directors behind the scenes making sure the cars pass in front of him just at the right time, and so do the people, to create the illusion that he's living in a normal world. And Truman hears the director. He hears him saying, send this car through, and the car drives by, and he thinks that's odd. And then he hears him saying the same about a person, and then the person comes by, and Truman thinks, well, this is really bizarre. What on earth am I hearing on my radio? Am I going insane? And that day he does something slightly different. Instead of going into work, which the director and everybody's expecting, he suddenly turns abruptly right, where they're not expecting him to go, and walks into what to him just looks like an office building. And lo and behold, he looks at the lift, and the lift doors are open. Instead of there being a lift behind the lift doors, there's actually a canteen where the cast are sitting munching their food. And the thing goes on in that line, and it's about Truman discovering that this thing that he thinks is the world and is common sense and is a real world is actually not. And we're kind of in that boat as well. And you get cracks in it that we notice and then kind of cover up quite quickly. Things that suddenly hit us. So if you take something that probably most of us of a certain age here will remember, quite a young age, 9/11. I will remember forever kind of being in an office at 21 St Thomas Street, opposite St Thomas's Hospital, and walking down the office. I can see it now, and I guess a lot of you are in that boat. Like my parents' generation used to be able to remember exactly what they'd been doing when John Kennedy was shot. And I can see Ian, who was an Australian who worked for me, and Tim turning round and saying to me, two aeroplanes have just flown into the World Trade Tower. And your common sense view of the world actually suddenly stops processing. You can't cope with that fact. You think, well, if you were saying one aeroplane had thrown into one of the towers of the World Trade Center, I could process that fact. There's been an accident. How can two aeroplanes fly into the two towers of the World Trade Center? That doesn't make sense. There's a kind of jolt in reality. And I could envisage two very small aeroplanes, perhaps, some kind of bizarre accident. And then as the day went on and the news kind of unraveled, it turned out that the aeroplanes had flown deliberately into the towers. And then, for a few hours in the news, there was great speculation about how on earth could that have happened? How on earth could professional pilots of American airliners have been somehow coerced, even if they had a gun against their heads, to fly their airplanes into the World Trade Center and into the other places they went? And then it obviously unravels that actually they hadn't. It had been the hijackers. But what's really fascinating about that whole thing, it catches everybody else out in terms of reality. It was a way we weren't used to looking at the world. It was a way we weren't used to thinking. So the kind of trick of just putting hijackers who learned to fly planes on simulators and with flying lessons actually worked. And we have to kind of, we readjusted our sense of reality. We now accept that things like that will happen and do happen. But that's a kind of a switch where you suddenly start seeing the world differently, and we all adopt to that, and we all see the world slightly differently. Also, if you travel physically, sometimes the world will look very different. I've been a couple of times out to Johannesburg for work, and that is a very different city, a very different place to London. It's a mile high up in the air, so the planes have to go a lot faster when they come in and out to land because the air is a lot thinner, but it's also quite a rough, violent place. All the houses are behind kind of barbed wire, and they have signs on them that say which particular armed response unit is responsible for looking after them. Who will come if something happens with a gun, which is very different to kind of Britain. And I remember coming home, and it was a bit like time travel, in that it was a very sudden transition back to kind of Britain, and like David Tennant suddenly tumbling out his TARDIS and wondering where he was. And I'd been in Johannesburg for over a week and took off, flew home, and within kind of 2 hours of landing was standing in a little village just outside Newbury, watching my young son again, playing football. And you suddenly do this double take. I looked around me and it just looks like this perfectly ordinary English scene. And you suddenly notice something. You suddenly notice, and it strikes you as odd, that the houses along the edge of this village green, well, they don't have barbed wire. They just have hedges. Some of them don't have anything. And some of them just have fences. And suddenly that That's the common sense way. That's the way Britain is. You know, what's funny about it? But you suddenly look at it and suddenly there is something miraculous about that. We live in a country where most of us sitting here just have houses that open onto the road. And that's fine. People aren't going to march into them and shoot us. And there is something incredible and miraculous and amazing about that. And you suddenly see the way the world is differently. Now, God is also quite into us seeing the world differently. If you go to kind of 2 Kings 17, and this is kind of slightly more of a Bible here for the iPod generation. This is where the prophet Elijah has been holed up in a city with his servant. And the prophet Elijah at the time isn't very popular. And the servant is somewhat alarmed when he wakes up the next morning, kind of pulls back the curtains and peers out and discovers that in the midst of the night, the city has been surrounded by enemies. And he thinks he and Elijah are in pretty deep trouble. And Elisha prayed, "O Lord," and this is for the servant, "open his eyes that he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And the horses of the chariots and fire saved the day. But what you get there is that God has quite an interesting view of the world, a different view. From God's perspective, the world looks quite different. Now, we try and apply common sense, and this is where common sense actually gets slightly more insidious and not quite such a good thing. Common sense actually says that God might be some kind of vague being up in the clouds that it's kind of okay to believe in, and that's where as Christians we start having some problems with common sense. Common sense also takes the Bible stories and it makes them appear kind of quite sweet and cute. So, for example, we read earlier about Herod and the birth of Jesus. Now, the birth of Jesus is something that's trotted out on Christmas cards and is there the whole time. And we don't tend to focus on that bit that I read about, where actually Herod goes and kills every child under, I can't remember whether it's 2 or 5, but basically goes on a mass murder spree and Jesus has to be bundled off to Egypt. So I kind of come back looking at that and start thinking, well, what's going on here with the world? What's happening with kind of Jesus' story? Is it this kind of cute story, or is there something else going on behind the scenes which is kind of relevant to us? And I'm just going to look very briefly at a few things about Jesus' story, because that's something it's really easy to relate to, and then bring it back to common sense. But that's interesting, because that's that sense of there being a battle, of Jesus being born into a battle and there being somebody really keen on doing him in before it had even started, is very interesting. There's that idea there that there is an enemy, there is an opposition, there is somebody or something trying to stop Jesus coming into the world. And you get that tension again all through Jesus' life. Very early on in Matthew 4, he's tempted by the devil. He's kind of stands on the devil kind of shows him all the kingdoms of the world and promises him that if he will only bow down and worship the devil, that he will give him all the kingdoms of the world. And for that to be meaningful, it must have been a real temptation, I think. There must have been a real possibility that Jesus could have turned around and said, "That's what I'm doing," which fortunately, he didn't. But there is that sense there of right at the beginning of his ministry, there being the devil and there being a battle and there being opposition. And Jesus speaks all the time about his kingdom and how it's different to the ordinary world. And if you start reading it, he's very obsessed with people not seeing. He tells paragraphs to make them see what he is trying to teach, to make them see the world as he sees it, to make them see this kingdom. And Jesus had quite a lot of problems with common sense himself, which we kind of tend to filter out, having travelled, unfortunately, a long way through time since Jesus was around. Common sense said that the Messiah, when he came, who was long prophesied, was going to be a warrior. And this, actually, from a Jewish perspective in kind of 30 AD, seemed quite sensible, because the Jewish nation was ruled by the Romans, and they were pretty kind of civilizing but also cruel and impressive. So it seemed pretty much common sense that the Messiah, when he came, was going to be a warrior who would defeat the Romans. And Jesus had to keep saying, well, that's not who he was, that he was actually bringing a kingdom of peace, a kingdom of God's love. And if you look at some of the parables in that, or some of Jesus' stories in that context, they're quite incredible. So actually, when he was going out and there was an argument about who you pay taxes to, and he looked at one of the coins and it had Caesar's face on it, the Roman king, and he said, well, it's got Caesar's face on it, it's Caesar's coin, you pay your taxes to Caesar. That, to us, is just a story. But at the time, that was an incredible thing to be saying, because what he was actually saying was, you don't rise up against the Romans. I'm not a warlike leader. I'm not creating a warlike kingdom. You pay your taxes to Caesar. And that was an incredible thing. Now, if we move on towards the cross, so we've looked very quickly at Jesus, that he wasn't building up a physical kingdom, that he was building up a different kind of kingdom. And he understood about common sense. He understood that life would go on in the way it does and the way we feel it does every day, just kind of rushing by us. He says at the end of Matthew, when he's talking about the last days, and he's talking about when he will come again, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating, drinking, and marrying. And this is how it will be until the end of time, until the coming of the Son of Man. So he understood that. Now, the cross, I think, is also something, when you step back and look at it slightly, is also something strange. We accept Jesus ended up on the cross, and you almost don't question the story, but if you actually step back from it, you think, well, kind of, that is a slightly strange thing to happen. It suggests that something was going on, as we know it was, quite deep below the surface of the world, in the sense of there being a battle and an enemy. Because actually, Jesus was a good guy. He wasn't doing anything particularly controversial. He was telling people to love people. He was healing the sick. Even the kind of wisest teachers of our present age admit that Jesus was a good guy. And yet, he ended up on the cross, because there was an enemy out there desperate to stop him and his message and what he was trying to say coming through to us. And then even after the cross, the story is quite interesting, because you would think there is the cross, there is the resurrection, and the resurrection, God made sure that people noticed. There was an earthquake, the temple curtain ripped, there was darkness came on the land when Jesus died. People were raised from the dead around Jerusalem. That's all actually, again, the dead being raised around Jerusalem is in the Bible, but it's one of the bits that doesn't usually get read out at Christmas so much. So some incredible things happen, and that was an incredible time. And you would expect, wouldn't you, the early disciples at that point would have gone off and done what they did, which was actually take the message to the ends of the earth, actually turn the Roman Empire within a few hundred years completely on its head, actually, being a time traveler, started a religious movement which has blasted through 2,000 years and kind of hits us in the face this morning in Reading. Kind of civilizations have come and civilizations have gone since that day of the resurrection, but Christianity had survived. But the people didn't do that. They kind of stayed shut inside their houses and were afraid. And it wasn't till God actually sent his Spirit and really, really intervened and showed them at Pentecost how different the world was, that he gave them power and the energy to be brave and to go out and to change the world. Now, if we bring those things back, so we looked at common sense and we've said, well, common sense is what we live by and what we think the real world is, but actually it's not quite as real. It doesn't quite stand up to things as much as we would expect it to. And that there is another reality, and the Bible is actually full of God kind of almost metaphorically opening the door and looking down into our world and shouting to us. So if you go back to the biblical story, it's a kind of ordinary common sense day for the shepherds, and suddenly there are angels in the sky shouting down to them, hey, look out, something incredible is going to be happening. But what's happened is over the enemy tries to kind of blind us with common sense and to thinking that the world is ordinary and to deceiving us. And the world is actually really extraordinary. And hopefully that's one of the things that are coming across. So what I think we need to draw from this is understanding how extraordinary the world is and how extraordinary we are in it. Now, if you look at kind of Neb sitting over here as a pastor, you could say he's a middle-aged pastor. I hope that's not being too rude of a kind of averagely sized church in a kind of average place in Reading. We're not like that amazing church in kind of America, where the two presidential candidates have just visited it. We're much smaller, although we would like to be bigger. And in one sense, that sounds quite, you know, quite small, quite ordinary. That's the way the world, probably a lot of people in the world would look at Nev. the way perhaps sometimes he kind of is tempted to look at himself. You could also look at it differently if you stood aside and looked at it with God's eyes. You could look down at Reading this morning and see it actually, as the Bible says, a place where there are powers and principalities, a place of absolutely incredible darkness, black, thick, pungent darkness. And if you were looking down on it like God, with people absolutely tormented, people trying desperately to live broken, damaged lives and not doing it very well. And you could look at our church meeting this morning and you would probably see this soaring, incredible column of blinding light going up to heaven. And you would look at it and you would say, well, Nev's actually a time traveller for kind of, I don't know, 15, 20 years, I'm not quite sure how long. He has been holding this group of people who are worshipping God and who are living a different way together. And actually, it's kind of, in one sense, it's Nev who lives at Amblecote Drive and an ordinary man. In another sense, you could also say, well, actually, you know, Nev and Gordon is here this morning. It's more like kind of Gandalf from The Lord of the Rings. You should actually be looking at somebody dressed in incredible clothes and holding a staff and wielding a kind of immense, incredible, miraculous power, because that is true. If you look at James and Emma's wedding yesterday, that in one sense, well, weddings are a bit boring and a bit ordinary. Their wedding was special because we love them and we know them, and it was even more special to kind of Nev because it was his son. But weddings and James and Emma is also something actually incredible that we don't normally see. In an age that actually believes in, and this is where we do funny things with words and common sense, if I say kind of bigamy, everybody thinks, my goodness, bigamy is a bad thing. But actually, most people out there, common sense said these days, they wouldn't call it bigamy, but they believe in serial monogamy, that you go from one marriage to another, and that's kind of, the world thinks that's okay. Interestingly, we wouldn't actually agree with bigamy and being married to two people at the same time, but if you kind of have relationships outside of marriage with two people at the same time, it's considered bad form, but it's not, you know, it's not terrible. Because that's the interesting thing that happens with common sense and the way it impinges upon them. But then, so if you come back to James and Emma, and actually, and that's one of the things that came out of the service, these guys are doing something absolutely incredible. That, you know, loads of people get married in churches and say the words without meaning it, but those guys yesterday were saying the words at that wedding services, and they were time travellers. They were making incredible promises that will bind them and affect them for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years of their lives, about how in a place of darkness, how in a place that believes in serial monogamy at best, how in a place that thinks kind of being committed to people is kind of old-fashioned and boring, they are actually standing together and saying, we don't agree with this. We are setting out on an adventure and we are going to be bound together for the rest of our lives. And that, again, is something incredible that happens and that common sense kind of makes us miss. So I just really wanted to bring in that sense. And that is true to all of us. We are not kind of boring people. We are shining stars, the Bible tells us, in a crooked and depraved generation. We are a light on a hill. We are salt of the earth. Salt makes things good. Salt preserves things. We are the yeast in bread, which makes it rise. We are God's people. We are, it tells us in Peter, we are strangers. We are sojourners in this place. We're almost like secret agents from another place. And I read all those things, and probably there's checks inside some of you, and it says, well, Christians are supposed to be shining stars. They're supposed to be lights on a hill. They're supposed to be light. They're supposed to be salt. And I'm not. But that is actually not true. You are. And one of the greatest things that the devil tries to do with common sense is lying to us about who we are and what we are. And you see in church, and particularly the things that are going on in our church at the moment, that kind of keeps cracking, that keeps fracturing, that keeps breaking. So you saw the way we were really praying for the young people this morning. And that is God absolutely, incredibly breaking in. But I think my challenge as a kind of time traveller and to you this morning is look at your lives, look at common sense, look at who you are, and then learn to look at yourself as God sees you. See these incredible things about yourselves and these incredible truths, and how life is not this boring, staid, trundling around that we think it is. Life is actually incredible. Life is actually miraculous. Life is an adventure. Life has God has already done these incredible things in our lives, which everybody here this morning more or less is taking for granted. We're not curled up in bed reading the Sunday Times or whatever, or plugged into our iPods. We've actually come out to church. We've come out to interact and see with God. That is something that most people in the world would consider insane and mad, and yet it's something we've done. I'm just going to leave you with a kind of final thought. I think the really important thing we need to be doing is really reaching out to God in prayer. That is how we kind of push through, like the world Truman was in that seemed the real world. We push through that with prayer to get God. And it's interesting, all the people who've been to Colombia and come back from Colombia, one of the things they've said with G12 that is really different in Colombia is they pray and they pray and they pray. And there is that sense of the heavens being open and God being able to move. And that, to kind of break through common sense, to break outside our world, is what we need to do. We need to be praying and reaching up to the heavens. And I'll leave you with one kind of strange thought. Why, it's an ordinary, boring morning. We're sitting stationary. But in the time I've been speaking, in the time I've been in church, the world is actually spinning. It's spinning so fast that New York, which is about 3,000 miles away, is only different from us than in terms of 5 hours. And what that means is the Earth spins and the sun's there, and in 5 hours the Earth has travelled that distance. So in the time you've been sitting here this morning, you've probably travelled 500, 600, 700 effortless miles. The world is nothing like it seems. We talk about the sun rising, the sun setting. Again, that's just words and common sense. The sun doesn't rise and set. The Earth tips. The sun stays compared to the Earth still. It just doesn't sound quite so good if you say, well, the Earth's tipped. But again, the whole way we use words and common sense is in one sense important, but in another sense it makes us see the way in the world that as Christians we need to challenge and we need to try and break through. So thank you.